Podcast.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
In 2010, the city of Vancouver, British Columbia, welcomed the world to its shores as host of the 21st Olympic Winter Games. The Olympic Charter mandates that each opening ceremony include an artistic program that showcases through music, dance, and live performance the unique culture and history of the host nation. It's also a tradition of sorts to make the opening ceremony as entertaining and extravagant as possible. Not one to break with tradition, Vancouver's opening ceremony was a dazzling three-hour spectacle consisting of over 4,000 performers and costing, combined with the closing ceremony, nearly $50 million to produce. The program was titled The Landscape of a Dream and included a welcome dance by the First Nations, singing by Nelly Furtado and Brian Adams, a simulation of the Northern Lights, a giant sparkling bear puppet, a ballet performance within a simulated forest grove, and a boy on a flywire soaring high above prairie wheat fields. The show was rich with Canadian imagery from all corners of the country, and for the most part, each symbol could be recognized by those with even a cursory knowledge of Canada. But then there was the devil in the flying canoe.
Anybody?
You're listening to Fireside Canada, my podcast about Canadian legends, lies, and lore. I'm David Williams. This episode is about an iconic legend that has captivated French-Canadian imaginations for centuries, and with good reason. It has all the things you want in a story. Love, danger, dark magic, a high-risk, high-speed chase, and a flying canoe. What's more Canadian than a canoe? It also deals with a universal human struggle, and it may be one of the earliest examples of uniquely Canadian folklore produced by colonial culture. About 1 hour and 50 minutes into the opening ceremony, the arena darkened and a giant orange moon lowered into position over center stage. An electric blue canoe, glowing softly in the darkness, slowly descended into view and took its position high overhead. A man stood inside, facing the audience. He wore a sleeveless black leather tunic, a blue kilt, a red maple leaf cape, and brown leather gauntlets. At the top of his head, his dark hair twisted upward in the shape of two menacing horns. In his left hand, he clutched a fiddle, in his right, a bow, which he waved about in dramatic arcs. His silhouette appeared on the face of the moon behind him as the canoe hovered in place, and he and his shadow briefly took turns playing their fiddles, accompanying a song performed by the orchestra below. When the song was over, the mysterious enchanted canoe and its demonic pilot flew up and disappeared, and a team of fiddlers and jiggers took the stage for the next sequence. The devil in the flying canoe was only on stage, or rather above it, for just over 2 minutes. But the image was so striking, so strange, that it caught the attention of a number of spectators. But what did it mean? Why did the devil suddenly appear over the same stage that would showcase prominent Canadian athletes, artists, and other luminaries throughout the night? What does the devil have to do with Canadian cultural heritage and identity? And what's with the flying canoe? The answer can be found in one of French Canada's most beloved and most enduring legends. It's called La Chasse Galerie, and it's older than the nation itself. The next time you visit a half-decent liquor store, swing by the Canadian beer section and look for a Quebec brand called Unibrew. There, among beers with names like Don Dudu and La Fin du Monde, you'll most likely find a strong amber ale called La Maudite, which translates to the cursed one or the damned. The label depicts 8 men, paddles in hand, packed inside a birch bark canoe as it flies over the French-Canadian countryside, lit by a full moon. At the bottom of the label, the devil crosses his arms and grins. This is the iconic imagery of La Chasse Galerie, sometimes referred to in English as the Wild Run, the Bewitched Canoe, or the Flying Canoe, that inspired those 2 minutes in the opening ceremony. The addition of a violin to the Olympic segments was no doubt a bit of artistic license on the part of the producers, who were inspired by the instrument's well-known association with the devil in European and North American folklore. But La Chasse Galerie has nothing to do with fiddles. Rather, it's about a group of homesick workers living far out in the wilderness who make a deal with the devil one winter's night, usually on Christmas or New Year's Eve, so they can visit their loved ones back home. They paddle through the air in their infernally enchanted canoe, join their friends and family for the evening's festivities, then rush back to their camp before dawn, which will signal the end of their Faustian deal. Before I tell you the story, it's important to know a little bit more about the people who first shaped and shared it over 3 centuries ago. Imagine it's the year 1660. The North American fur trade is heating up, along with what would come to be known as the Beaver Wars of the 17th century. Back in Europe, beaver skin hats continue to be the height of men's fashion, and polite society has deemed that a person is simply not worth knowing unless their head is crowned with the oily pelt of everyone's favorite buck-toothed rodent. This insatiable desire for furs has virtually wiped out beaver populations in Russia, while previous North American hotspots, like New York's Hudson River Valley, are getting sparse. So the hunt has pushed north, to the wilderness surrounding the St. Lawrence River and the colony of New France. Now, you might think that becoming the center of the fur trade, one of the biggest industries in the world at the time, would be a welcome event for the fledgling colony. Instead, the people of New France are in the grip of panic. While the fur trade is essential in keeping all those European aristocrats looking their best and those involved flush with cash, it's also become an important part of the First Nations economy. When the hunt for pelts pushed north, the Iroquois Five Nations, the most powerful indigenous group in the area, decided that they should expand as well. With a few warm words of encouragement from the Dutch and the English, trading partners of the Iroquois and lifelong frenemies of the French, the Iroquois have clashed again and again with the people of New France and their indigenous allies, the Algonquin, the Innu, and the Huron. By 1660, the conflict has been raging for decades, complete with captives, beheadings, and fire. To make things even worse, the colony of New France is woefully underpopulated. What will become known as Quebec City is little more than an outpost with a few hundred government officials, clergy, merchants, and indentured servants. And though the small village of Montreal, also known as Ville-Marie, has just received a new shipment of immigrants, it's not enough to quell the sense of fear and helplessness that comes with the rumor of a pending Iroquois invasion. Almost everyone in the little colony goes about their business with one eye fixed on the horizon, whispering about the attack that is sure to happen any day now. It's just a matter of time. It has to be. A series of dark and disturbing signs of seemingly supernatural origin have all but guaranteed their slaughter. Just that winter, an earthquake had struck Montreal. Then, a red comet appeared in the sky for over a month, only visible in the dead of night, its tail pointed straight at town. A local Ursuline nun and future Catholic saint, who was living in Montreal at the time, Marie of the Incarnation, wrote to her son about how, quote, a man on fire, totally enveloped in flames, was seen midair, and, in another incident, a thunderous and horrible voice was heard, end quote. Her letter mentioned reports of confused cries of women and children echoing from across the water, and how an unborn infant was heard wailing from inside its mother's womb. Finally, both Marie and the Jesuit relations described the terrifying vision of, quote, canoes that appeared to hover, all on fire, in midair about Quebec. Here you are, at the edge of the known world, thousands of miles away from your family, the wilderness at your door. Men and canoes burn in the summer sky. Unborn babies wail from within their mother's womb. There are cries of anguish across the water, terrifying comets and booming voices in the air. Is the world coming to an end? Are these signs of an impending doom? Whatever the future holds, the people of New France seem certain that things will get a whole lot worse before they get better. Now, nightmarish omens of death and destruction or not, a guy's gotta eat. Some men who arrive at the colony take one look at the terrified merchants and indentured servants and decide there's a better way to eke out a living on the frontier. They will follow in the footsteps of other young men who, decades earlier, were sent to live with and learn from their First Nations allies. They're known as les carreuses de bois, or the runners of the woods, as they spend most of their time traveling hundreds of kilometers into the wilds, usually by canoe, to trap game and trade with the First Nations. They essentially act as the middlemen of the fur trade, but they're unregulated and unlicensed, and therefore live outside the law. It's a hard and dangerous life. 12 to 14 hours of travel each day, little to no hygiene or health care, contending with thieves, wildlife, and harsh weather, and living off a diet of corn, meat scraps, and bear fat for 12 to 18 months at a time. At the end of a long day, they make camp, either in makeshift cabins or simply under the stars, and tell stories to pass the time. The legend of La Chasse Galerie was likely first shared over those winter campfires of the 1660s. Then, between the voyageurs and lumberjacks of the 18th and 19th centuries, and then with anyone who loves a good story and who might be feeling a bit homesick during a long winter's night. That last point is especially significant today. I'm recording this episode in the winter of 2020, in the middle of the second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. This year, many Canadians and many around the world will be spending the winter holidays isolated from their friends and family. Feeling disconnected, alone, and uncertain about the future, I think many of us have a greater capacity to sympathize with the men in this story who were willing to risk not just their lives, but their eternal souls to spend just one night in the company of their loved ones. The tradition of sharing this kind of tall tale with a stiff drink spans generations and geographical boundaries. And while the details may have changed slightly through time and through telling, with the storyteller occasionally adding their own flavor, the spirit of the legend remains the same. As for me, my first exposure to this classic Canadian tale was through a bottle of La Maudite, shared with a friend who had recently returned from living in Quebec, and who, a year before, had shared a bottle with a friend from Gatineau, one cold winter night along the St. Lawrence River. That night, she had asked her friend about the curious illustration of the flying canoe that she found on the bottle's label and was told the story. Later, my friend told me, and now I'd like to share it with you. So grab a beer or a bottle of rum or brandy if you want to be really authentic, take a seat by the fire, and I'll tell you the tale of La Chasse Galerie. The last day of the year brought a harsh wind that swept through the valley and piled snow on the windward trees. The morning sky glowed cold and dull as a worn hatchet cheek as the men moved along the river. Their hands, red, raw, and soaking beneath thick rabbit-lined gloves, flexed and twisted as they paddled their canoe, heavy with pelts, through the icy water. Their cheeks flushed with red fire, and their breath came in great bursts like steam from smokestacks. They dipped and sliced through spray and ice as the men sang songs to keep their spirits high, their voices hanging low in the valley. Later that night, the wind calmed and the moon shone hard-faced and full in the winter sky. Jacques, warmly wrapped in a caribou skin and fuzzy-headed from too much rum, slept soundly by the fire, his feet propped up on a half-split log. Eight sets of snowshoes sat at the edge of the light, a bright pool of water stretching beneath them. Green pine needles slipped along its surface like miniature skiffs, and the orange light of the flames danced across it and rippled up the trees that lined the camp. Just a few hours prior, the clearing had been full of talking and laughter as the men toasted the new year. Now, all was quiet, save for the low muttering of voices beyond the tree line, the snapping of burning logs, and Jacques' long, slow snores. There was a crunch of snow as a figure loped up the hill and stood with its back to the fire. Jacques woke to the toe of a boot nudging his shoulder and a black silhouette looming above. It spoke with a dark voice. "Get up, Jacques. We need your help." Jacques yawned sharply and rubbed his face. "What is it?" He blinked and sat up. "What time is it?" The figure stepped into the light, and Jacques recognized the face of Nicolas Baptiste, the newest addition to the team. His gaunt face wore a boyish grin, and his green eyes flashed in the firelight. His tall, thin frame was tightly wrapped in a thick black capote, cinched with a crimson sash, and a mess of oily black hair cascaded from his head to the tops of his wide shoulders. "Just past midnight," Baptiste answered, still grinning. "The boys and I are heading to Montreal. We thought you would like to join." "Montreal?" Jacques laughed, unsure he heard right. He could still feel the effects of the rum, but his head was starting to clear. "Are you mad or just drunk?" Baptiste laughed, his breath steaming between a sneer of teeth. "Not mad," he said, brushing snow from his shoulders. "Not drunk either. Just looking for a few hours of fun before dawn."
"Montreal is a 2-month journey away," Jacques said.
"We're here until spring, unless you expect some sort of miracle." Baptiste grinned wider. He snatched Jacques' hat from a nearby branch and dropped it in his lap. "Come with me." At the bottom of the hill, beyond a small stand of trees, 6 men stood huddled, paddles in hand, around the team's huge birch-bark canoe. Jacques felt a tug of apprehension, a hazy, half-forgotten memory that burned in the back of his mind. A story the old-timers told around the fur camps of the Pays d'Onot, about men who risked their souls for a night's escape. Jacques looked at Baptiste, his eyebrows raised. "Yes," Baptiste said, giving a proud nod. "We will run La Chasse Galerie." Jacques studied Baptiste's face, looking for a hint of a joke. There was none.
"You are mad," Jacques said, and shook his head.
"I'll have no part in it." Baptiste laughed again, and his white teeth caught the moonlight. "You're quite the old woman, aren't you, Jacques? The boys here said you'd never agree, but I told them no, you were made of sterner stuff. One of our own."
"One of your own," Jacques said, his voice rising. "And who are you, Les Maudites? This is a deal with the devil."
"And completely harmless," Baptiste said, wagging a finger in the air. "Provided we follow the rules of the agreement." He bent and picked up a paddle, examining the blade. "I myself have done the run 6 times already, and voila." He spread his arms wide and smiled. "The devil hasn't got me yet."
"That's all fine," Jacques said, turning back to the fire, "but it's not an agreement I'm willing to make."
Baptiste put a hand on Jacques' shoulder and squeezed. "Come now. Don't you miss your friends? Maybe a girl back home?" He gestured to the 6 men stamping their feet impatiently in the cold.
"And what of them? Like you, they've toiled in this forsaken wilderness for months. Like you, they've worked their hands raw and splitting each day and have months still until the snows melt. All they want is a few hours with their loved ones. Surely you won't deny them that."
"Then go," Jacques said, turning to face them. "No one is stopping you. Why must I be a part of this madness?"
"We need an 8th man," one of them said plainly.
Baptiste pushed the heavy paddle to Jacques' chest. 8. Or it won't work." Jacques looked at the others. Their eyes were eager, nervous. Baptiste was right. The weather and work had been brutal this season. The snows had come early, deals had fallen through. They were light on their quota, even lighter in their rations, and the weeks leading up to Noel and the New Year left them all feeling homesick. And yes, though there was no girl waiting for him, not yet anyway, he did have his eye on one little blonde back in Montreal. He imagined all of them singing, drinking, and dancing, properly welcoming the New Year in the little town over 300 miles away. 300 miles from the cold, these desolate trees, and this darkness. If what Baptiste said was true, they could be wrapped in that warmth in only a few hours.
"Come now," Baptiste urged. "Where is your courage?"
Jacques looked up. Baptiste was no longer grinning. He stood solemn and somber beneath the sky, waiting for an answer. Jacques' will, so resolute moments ago, broke and shattered like autumn ice. He grabbed the paddle and silently nodded his agreement. The men cheered with relief. "Excellent," Baptiste said. He clasped his hands and paced the frozen ground. "The rules," he announced. "There are just three, and they're so simple even a child could follow, let alone able men such as yourselves. Be warned, however, the pact is a serious one. Make one mistake, and we'll all be damned to hell." Baptiste pivoted to face them. "First, you must not speak the name of the Almighty during the voyage, neither in prayers nor in passing." The men nodded. "Second, you cannot touch a cross as we travel. This includes the church steeples we pass." One man, young-faced and fair-haired, stepped forward and, after a moment's hesitation, drew a wooden cross necklace up over his head and hung it on a branch of a nearby tree. It swayed gently in the moonlight. "Good man," Baptiste said. "Anyone else?" The others shook their heads. "Bon." "The third and final rule. Watch what you drink. Each man here knows the loosening effect liquor can have on his judgment and his tongue. One wrong word means the end for us all." He paused, letting the words linger before grinning again and clapping his hands. "That's it. Look where you go, watch what you say, and limit your drink. Follow these rules, and this heavy promise of our souls will be nothing more than breath on the air." The men took their places in the canoe. "One last thing," Baptiste called from the stern. "We must return before sunrise when the agreement dissolves. We don't want to be up there," he paused and pointed skyward, "when first light hits. So paddle hard." He took his seat and readied his paddle. "Repeat after me." The sound of a dark and secret language tumbled from his mouth, and each man repeated in unison his invocation. After a moment, when the last of the foreign words passed their lips, Baptiste tapped each side of the canoe three times with his paddle, then chanted, his voice almost a whisper, "Acabris, Acabas, Acabram." The last word was hardly spoken when the canoe burst several feet off the ground and shot forward like an arrow, throwing the men off balance and jolting the air from their lungs. They sped wide-eyed and white-knuckled above the snowy ground, gripping the gunwale and staring in disbelief at the passing horizon. A clump of white pines, giants against the starlit sky, rushed toward them.
"Dig!"
Baptiste shouted.
"Dig, or we won't clear those trees!"
The men snapped into action and dug deeply with their paddles, climbing higher and higher with each stroke, their breath steaming in the air. The sound of thunder erupted below them as they felt branches, heavy and stiff with snow and ice, bend and scrape along the bottom of the canoe. The birch bark rattled and groaned as the keel sliced through ice-crusted caps of pine, and the boat rocked as they burst into open sky and leveled off, a trail of ice glimmering like starlight in their wake. There was no sound, save for the crisp night air splitting over the bow of the canoe. They slipped along the winter wind as their paddles beat the air and dark heads of trees rushed below them. Minutes passed, and they came upon the river, a bright band of silver shining like a mirror in the moonlight, stretching for miles through the wilderness below. The forest slowly receded like waves on a shore, and Jacques noticed the cold for the first time. He was sweating below his coat, but the air outside was sharp and chill, and he took a moment to close his collar tightly around his neck. He risked a peek over the side and saw native campfires burning in snowbound silence below them, as cold and distant as stars. Then came farmhouses, washed in the light of the full moon, smoke slowly curling from their chimneys, and then the village, where tin steeples, shining like bayonets, drifted silently past in the darkness. They pressed on, gliding over forests and rivers until the lights of Montreal glimmered in the distance. "Look there!" someone called from the bow. There were shadows of people loping along the snow-covered streets. "Let's give them a story to tell," Baptiste said. He steered the canoe closer to the ground and began to sing in a loud, booming voice. The rest of the men, bolstered by the journey and excited that they would soon see their families, laughed and joined in. If anyone trudging home in those small hours had, at just the right moment, lifted their head and looked to the stars, they would have seen a flying canoe, silhouetted by a pewter moon, with eight men singing in unison as they glided over the rooftops. Blink, and they were gone, swallowed by the night sky, leaving only echoes of their voices rattling through the icy streets below. Another church steeple or two, an arc over the harbor, a few more lonely farmhouses, and the men reached their destination. In minutes, they had slid carefully along a snowbank, dragged the canoe to the riverside, and hid it among the hummocks. A few minutes more, and they were banging on the shining door of a large home, the sound of music and laughter bursting behind its bright, frost-covered windows. They were greeted with cheers, embraces, and, from those who drank less than the others, puzzled surprise. Weren't they out collecting furs? Where did they come from, and why at such a late hour? Before the men could answer, Baptiste pushed his way to the front of the group and grinned. Oh, he sighed wearily as he slapped their backs. We've traveled a long way to get here, and we're eager to join the party. Give us a chance to dance, eat, and drink, and then, in the morning, if you still have questions, we'll be happy to answer them all. It seemed enough to satisfy, and the curious ones shrugged and disbanded. Jacques began searching for his blonde, and the men lost themselves in revelry. Hours passed. Several dances and a few drinks later, when the little blonde excused herself for a moment, three of the men pushed across the floor with a panicked look on their faces. Jacques, one cried breathlessly, we've stayed too long. We need to leave. A flush of heat hit Jacques' face. Had time really gone that quickly? We can't find Baptiste. You must help us search. Leave now? When things were going so well? What would she think if they were to suddenly leave without so much as a goodbye? The terms of the deal flooded his mind, and Baptiste's warning filled his head. Make one mistake, and we'll all be damned to hell. No, he realized they had to leave. Now. Jacques searched the thinning crowd, but unable to find any trace of the girl, reluctantly followed the others outside. After a short but desperate search, they found Baptiste in a churchyard, his right arm slung around the neck of a stone angel in solemn graveside prayer, his left hand lifting a nearly empty bottle to its lips, urging it to drink. He saw the men approaching and greeted them jovially, an empty grin on his face. Boys, he said, welcome. Come, join me in a toast to the new year. It took precious minutes to explain the situation to Baptiste, the late hour, the coming sunrise, the looming deal with the devil. He argued, sneered, and swore, but ultimately agreed to leave the bottle in the angel's care and join them on the voyage back to camp. The eight men hurried to the riverside and set their canoe upon the snow once more. Baptiste may be too drunk to steer, one man said. Does anyone else know the way? Nonsense, Baptiste said sharply. He swore under his breath, snatched a paddle from the ground, and dropped himself into the stern. Get in, he barked. With their souls at stake and seeing no other options, the men hesitantly took their seats. Jacques looked over his shoulder and gave a nervous smile. Just straight on back to camp, eh, Baptiste? Steer toward the mountain as soon as you see it. I know my role, Baptiste snapped. You mind yours. He rapped three times on either side of the canoe and chanted the three words. They leapt into the air and rose through a moonless sky, much darker now than when they arrived. Baptiste pushed and pulled heavily on his paddle, and the canoe lurched violently to one side and then the other. They soared narrowly over a church steeple, then dipped downward, nearly cleaving the cross from its perch. The canoe then sped toward a huge maple tree, its branches stretching like black fingers toward them. Right, Baptiste! Steer right! The man shouted over the wind, and Baptiste turned sharply. The canoe scraped along the branches, then evened out, gliding a few feet above an open field blanketed in white. Snowdrifts knocked the bow of the canoe, kicking up clouds of ice. They arced left, jumped a fence post, then pushed upward once more, paddling through icy starlight. "Stay focused," one of the men shouted. "Keep steering this way, and you'll send us straight to the devil." A shimmer of violet bloomed beyond the valley. The sun was near breaching. The great mountain rose slow and dark along the bruised horizon, and the way to their camp was clear. They darted westward, desperate to outrun the dawn, gritting their teeth and doggedly beating their paddles in the chill morning air, digging the blades deeply, flicking and digging again, their breath steaming, their arms cycling in unison like the crankshaft of a train churning through the sky. They kept their heads down, eyes forward, paddling, paddling, not stopping, unrelenting, though their muscles ached and their eyes burned. Forward, 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 Jacques thought, his movement automatic, his ears throbbed, his eyes fixed on the growing mountainside. The same towns, rocks, trees unrolled below them in a blur, and it seemed to Jacques that they might succeed, that they might clear the river and pines and set down at camp before daybreak. Suddenly, Jacques felt the canoe tip back a moment and turned to see Baptiste standing in the stern. "We won't make it," Baptiste said plainly. He gave a short laugh under his breath, then inhaled deeply, threw his head back, and laughed again, this time loud, frenzied. His eyes lolled in their sockets. Another church rushed towards them, and Baptiste yelled and gave the paddle a twist. The canoe tipped, nearly throwing the men over the side. The crazed man jerked his paddle over his head and sent them plummeting downward, slamming the stern on the top of the church, spilling splinters of shingles into the air as it sliced along the roof. The men looked on in horror as their canoe threatened to run aground, and they dug with their paddles to push upward again, watching the rooftop surge below them as they paddled. They were so focused on the church roof below them and the sun looming at their backs that none of them thought to look up. If they had, they would have seen the church steeple directly in their path. They would have known to brace when they struck it and to duck when the cross at the top of the spire came crashing down upon them. Instead, they knew only confusion and the feeling of tumbling through wood and branches and snow into darkness, and the sound of Baptiste still laughing. The devil had claimed his prize. No trace of the men was ever found, save for some moldering furs at their abandoned campsite discovered by two Huron boys the following spring. But their legacy remains. Some claim to have run La Chasse Galerie themselves, while others claim to know someone who has done so and who has lived to tell the tale. Most who hear these stories pass them off as the tall tales of braggarts or a bit of fun to brighten a dark winter's night. But then there are those who claim to have seen a flying canoe racing through the winter air, doomed to repeat the same ill-fated voyage year after year, forever. They say that, in the small hours of Christmas or New Year's Day, one simply needs to look to the moon and, with a bit of luck and the right perspective, you just might catch a glimpse of eight men in their birch bark canoe paddling across the sky. The ending of La Chasse Galerie, and thus the fate of the men involved, depends on who's telling the tale. The ending that I first heard, the same I just shared with you, came from that friend of a friend in Gatineau. The men fell into darkness, the devil took their souls, and they were cursed to ride La Chasse Galerie forever, paddling the wind, singing their songs, and soaring high over Montreal every winter night in their flying canoe. Though this is the ending that I prefer, and I'll go into more detail later about why, it's not the best known. That honor goes to the story written by the French-Canadian publisher, author, and former mayor of Montreal, Honoré Beaugrand, which first appeared in English in the August 1892 edition of the Century Illustrated Monthly Magazine. In Beaugrand's story, also titled La Chasse Galerie, many of the elements are the same, but this time the men narrowly escape damnation. On their way back to camp, the men get distracted and slam their canoe into a pine tree before losing consciousness. They wake in their beds the next morning, bruised and battered, but with their lives and their souls still intact. They're told by their colleagues that they were found sleeping in the snow beneath a large pine tree and were carried inside. Told as a first-person narrative by a cook in a lumber camp 40 years after the event, it ends with a warning to those who might be foolish enough to deal with the devil. Still, it's less of a cautionary tale and more of a thrilling story about a narrow escape from the clutches of evil. It's a happier ending that, perhaps, is a little more palatable to Victorian-era sensibilities. That, and the fact that it was published in both English and French, making it accessible to a much wider audience, perhaps explains why Beaugrand's story is the most well-known version today. But back in 1892, when Beaugrand first published his story, it's likely that people would have been more familiar with a version that's closer to the version that I just shared. What's more, the idea of a flying canoe powered by the devil was nothing new back in 1892. Beaugrand talks about it in a footnote. He says, "This narrative is founded on a popular superstition dating back to the days of the Careaux de Bois under the French regime and perpetuated among the voyageurs in the Canadian Northwest. The shantymen of a later date have taken up the tradition, and it is in the French settlements bordering the St. Lawrence River that the legends of La Chasse-Galerie are especially well known at the present time. The writer has met many an old voyageur who affirmed most positively that he had seen bark canoes traveling in midair, full of men paddling and singing away under the protection of Beelzebub, on their way from the timber camps of the Ottawa to pay a flying visit to their sweethearts at home." That little introduction explains why, when the narrator of Beaugrand's story was invited to run La Chasse-Galerie 40 years earlier, he doesn't have to ask what that means. He knows. All of the men know. And the reader would too. In 1892, if you're from French North America, La Chasse-Galerie is likely a familiar cultural artifact that Beaugrand has simply expanded upon. Indeed, there are other versions of La Chasse-Galerie that can be found throughout Quebec and the former region of Acadia, in places like New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, Nova Scotia, and parts of northern Michigan and New England. In one telling, often relayed as a Christmas story, everyone survives except for the blasphemer, who vanishes and is never seen or heard from again. In another, the man who instigates the journey turns out to be the devil himself, and he deliberately steers the canoe toward danger in an effort to break the pact. Yet another tells how the men visit their loved ones only to be largely ignored as if they're not entirely present. They seem to haunt the festivities like Christmas ghosts, attending only in spirit. The following morning, astonished townspeople find the men dead, frozen in the snow near the home they visited the night before. Finally, in what might be the most bone-chilling and disturbing ending of them all, the men violate the terms of the agreement and are transformed into a gaggle of honking Canadian geese. Truly the worst punishment one can imagine. Sometimes the canoe is replaced by a log or even an axe handle or a simple piece of wood that grows in size to accommodate the travelers. But with just a few exceptions, the core elements are often there. The lonely men, their loved ones back home, the devil, the deal, the voyage, and the risk. So now you've heard the story, but questions still abound. Where do all of these elements come from? What do they mean? And why is the legend known as La Chasse-Galerie? I'll share all of that, along with some additional stories, next time, in part two. That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening and for joining me in becoming part of a Canadian folk tradition. Now that you know the story, share it. And remember, if someone offers you a ride in their flying canoe, you might want to sit that one out, or at the very least, ask to see their pilot's license. Fireside Canada is written and recorded by me, David Williams. Sound design and mixing is by Ryan Clark. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving this podcast a positive review. If you want to help even further, you can support me through my website. Every little bit helps to keep the fire burning and the Library of Legends growing. Learn more at firesidecanada.ca.